It's the Election Issues edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, quitting skepticism, super languages, and the big election issues of this election. Let's begin episode 210.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, Ethan, I was going to start the show by asking if you heard about the new permanent museum opening up in Stockholm, all about ABBA. And then I found something weird. And I mean, wonderful, but more weird. Both wonderful. Did you know that May is National Masturbation Month? It's the 1 month of the year where you get to celebrate the one love you can always count on. Did you know that along with this particular month, there's an event, and it's called a Masturbate-a-thon. Really, it's for charity. It's live. It's happening this Sunday, May 27th. It says 10 a.m. to midnight, although I think that was a bit of a typo. A 14-hour wank session isn't so much of a marathon as, well, just cruel.
Well, I mean, it depends on what they're using, I suppose.
True. There's pledge forms and everything. And yes, it's open to both genders. They even have other events going on, such as the Greatest Distance Contest. I'll leave it up to your imagination, distance of what.
So what are they donating exactly?
They are donating money. They're not donating organic material.
Precious bodily functions?
Yes. Although I was quite amazed that the record for the greatest distance was done by a guy named Punk9. I don't think that's his real name. At 13 feet, which I must admit is quite impressive. Besides the sex, there's also art show, discussion of panels, other social gatherings. It's the people who sponsor this Masturbate-a-thon also have something which I thought was amazing and didn't know existed, a Masturbation Hall of Fame. Although I must admit I was a little disappointed when I actually found out what it was. So yes, it's not what you think it sounds like, you dirty birds. It's about people who promote healthy sex, like Margaret Cho, Jamie Lee Curtis, the former Attorney General of the United States, Marilyn Joyce Elder, who actually lost her job by saying that, you know, masturbation should be taught in school, and that was like seen as horrible back in the 90s. So after the election, I have a few days free. Want to make a pledge? No, seriously. The health benefits of this sort of personal exercise is well documented. It just makes you happier. It's a universal that brings us all together. But Ethan, not everyone is happy. Some word about some high-profile breakup?
Well, yeah. So as Don hinted to, we're talking about deep riffs. So this past week, P.Z. Myers, the outspoken and irrepressible author of Pharyngula, recently announced that he is no longer a member of the skeptic movement. And no, he hasn't found Jesus or anything like that. He's just really angry. Fortunately, we now know how to make him happy again.
Exactly.
So P.Z. was attending the Orange County Freethought Conference, and Myers was apparently called out by the JREF's Jamie Ian Swiss in a talk which, supposedly, I know I haven't actually seen video of this event, but apparently Swiss called Myers stupid and a liar. Now, the talk is actually basically Ian Swiss's version of the talk he did last year at TAM, where he talked about having separate tents for atheism and skepticism. And it was actually, I mean, not a horrible talk by any stretch. There were issues that I think me and Don maybe had with it, but otherwise it was actually kind of reasonable.
It was one of those things that if he had like 10 points, I'd say 8 or 9, we thought we were right on board. And it's just, there seemed to be one area where he kept hammering sort of an anti-atheist sort of ilk that seemed to rub people the wrong way.
Right. So this debate basically is the same old debate that's been happening for the last 20 years of, Where is that fine line in the sand that divides organized skepticism and organized atheism? And, you know, according to Swiss, skepticism is where it's at. That's his domain. That's what he thinks is the best thing for us to be focusing our time on. And atheism, on the other hand, well, you know, atheism is not a faculty of science. It's not inherently employing critical thinking. So you're just as likely to encounter, you know, believers of homeopathy or all manners of woo, as, you know, James Randi would say, in sort of the atheist tent. Now, I think most of us, myself and Don, and most of our listeners would say that's BS, but that's what Swiss's position is. And you can imagine how someone like P.Z. Myers would feel about that. So you take that initial point there, and then whatever happened at this conference, maybe there was a heated Q&A. I don't know if Swiss knew that P.Z. Myers was in the audience. Maybe he did. Maybe it was meant to be a joke, who knows, but tempers got the best of it, and it looks like there was a pretty serious disagreement. And, you know, it's kind of surprising, because I'm consistently amazed that this debate keeps happening, that people haven't sort of gotten tired of it yet, you know?
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, I think we've talked on the show before about the idea of sort of a quote-unquote real skeptic and quote real atheist, but again, it's like people in both sides of the tent. So in the atheist tent and in the skeptic tent, you have people who will, what's the word we used before the show, go off the rail. And to somehow think that if you are a quote-unquote scientific skeptic, you never get things wrong and you never go into the area of woo or what have you. And conversely, I mean, there are some people who are atheists and go way off the rail on some issues. It's not something that's unique to any one tent.
Exactly. And, I mean, the whole concept of going off the rails, we should know by now, is a heuristic of having a brain. Our brains are not designed to be skeptics. We're designed to notice patterns and assume connections where there aren't any connections. And there's so many high-profile cases of this happening, everything from, you know, skeptics who are global warming deniers to atheists who believe in psychics. It shouldn't be surprising anyone. And I think additionally, given the fact that there's been some high-profile discussion about this between people like P.Z. Myers or Steve Novella or others, who I guess you would call quote-unquote leaders, depending if you want to characterize them like that, but you would think that Swiss would have considered updating his position at least a little bit, because since last year there have been some pretty big conversations about this.
Well, and I think where he misses the boat perhaps is, again, what's the word I'm looking for here? Some people will have bad ideas, right? And we kind of will associate all their ideas with this one person. So Bill Maher in atheism, because he's a good kicking post, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Bill Maher is far from a good skeptic. Sure. But that doesn't mean that his atheism is any bad or worse. You know what I mean?
I think I do. And one of the points that keeps coming up is this notion of scientific skepticism, which is a term that I think we've used, and I find it useful in some ways to focus on kind of like evidence-based inquiry.
Well, you know, Swiss, I think, mentions it and does a good thing of it, is that it is not a belief but a system of thought. It's not the end result, it's how you get there. And again, maybe that's part of his issues with atheism, because atheism is sort of like, boom, here's what I believe. And he says, well, no, skeptics are different. They're how do I get to that belief? That's the journey that defines what a skeptic is.
Right. I wanted to quote PZ with regards to the term scientific skepticism, just a little bit here. So, quote, I was also annoyed by the skeptic movement's appropriation of the term scientific all over the place, except that it's a science, quote, that doesn't make use of accumulated prior knowledge, that abandons all concepts of the null hypothesis, and that so narrowly defines what it will accept as evidence that it actively excludes huge domains of knowledge. It's toothless science that fetishizes consumer protection over understanding.
Now, I assume he means consumer protection as in it wants to remain popular with as many people, not corporate consumers.
Well, I think he's referring to sort of the anti-homeopathy, anti-alternative medicine angle to it. And I'm not going to say that I agree with PZ there, or even, but I'm not going to say that I totally disagree with him either. I think that this is, it's an interesting dichotomy. By or
no. I'm going to help.
Okay, yeah, go reference. Ahead.
So I think PZ is doing a switcheroo, which I think is wrong. I mean, I understand why he's doing it. I'm not disagreeing with part of what he's saying. Scientific skepticism, again, just means applying the scientific method to the idea of skepticism. It's not like the study of skepticism. It's not like a science unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's merely one tool of the idea of being a skeptic. So I think in a way, he does a bit of a shift there. I do understand, though, his frustration is the idea is that, and again, I'm going to go back because I think Bill Maher works this way, because Bill Maher calls himself a skeptic. Right. Whereas he's very focused in his application of the scientific method,
mm-hmm.
that he applies it good to areas of religion and a few other areas, but seems to totally ignore it when it comes to things like medicine. So I think PZ Myers is upset that some people who call themselves scientific skeptics are abusing the term by saying, well, scientific skepticism applies to this area, but in this other area, I'm going to make exceptions because I know that the big pharma is out to get me or some weird thing like that. That it's not a discipline like science is.
Well, I think he's taking issue with a lot of the ways that we frame it. And that's what I want to get at is I think this whole framing of the question is problematic to begin with. When you create a dichotomy that skeptics are one thing and atheists are another thing, or that the scientific method is how we determine things are true or not, and you know, atheism is just a judgment call or whatever, I think that's a kind of a dumb way of phrasing this question, because so many people arrive at their skepticism or their atheism in so many different ways. I mean, like, I arrived at skepticism independent of whether or not I believed in God. It was never a question of God for me. It was a question of aliens and conspiracy theories. That's how I got into it. It was never like I never once gave a thought to did God exist. I was an atheist when I was like 14.
No. You know? I think I was an atheist first and came into skepticism. I mean, I think I've always been skeptical.
Yeah.
But I remember being a little kid and wanting to believe in UFO landings and the pyramids might have been made by aliens and all that sort of thing. And like I say, as you learn how to think and you develop, you learn to rule out the things. Which again leads into another interesting false dichotomy or straw man is, I mean, what does the term atheist really mean in a skeptical context? Because, I mean, technically, most claims of atheism you can't make, because most gods can't be proven one way or the other. You can, in some narrow casting sense, say like the Judeo-Christian concept of God is logically self-contradictory. I can be an atheist against that God.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some other gods that are defined either whimsically or so ethereally that you can't really say scientifically that you're an atheist. In that sense, the term atheism seems somewhat meaningless.
Well, yeah, I mean, even in those situations where you have like the sort of very vague, spiritualized conception of a god or gods, at a certain point, it's become so vague and mysterious that it's kind of meaningless to begin with. So you would never really even give it scientific credence. It would be sort of like saying, let's investigate the possibility that we're all brains in a vat.
You know, I thought another interesting, because I just refreshed myself on his TED Talk he did a year ago, so this is not the same one that PZ Myers and him had the blow up. But he did say something interesting. He had this one line, what was it? Give a man a thought, and he thinks for a day. Teach him how to think, and he has thoughts for a lifetime, right? And he said that, you know, really what he wants to focus on is if you know how to apply the ideas of skepticism, even if you don't apply them universally, even if you only do it in a little narrow area, but you learn how to do it, it will sort of creep. Eventually, it will become your main way of viewing the whole world, which seems to go contradictory to kind of his other line, which is, says, I don't mind you coming into my tent, but don't move my tent. Which was an odd sort of
mix. It was really a strange statement. And that was one of the things that really I could not get on board with.
Yeah.
That particular statement. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back after this.
In the cool of the evening when everything, you know, there's nothing sexier than voting on a hot summer day. Be sure to vote in the 40th Provincial General Election Tuesday, May 14th. For more information, go to elections.bc.ca. First I say no, I've got some plans for tonight, and then I stop and say,
standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, I have a question for you.
Yeah, but
do you think all languages have descended from one super language? Yes, I see.
Yeah,
so that's a very good point.
That's ancient McClenaganese for, yes, probably. Well, I don't know. See, it's one of those things. You're dealing with the idea of, what is it called?
Evolution?
But where it evolves, the same thing evolves in very different contexts.
Oh, yeah. What is that term called?
Sort of like the idea that, you know, squirrels learn how to fly, bats learn how to fly, birds learn how to fly. They all have an adaptation to flying. Well, okay, squirrels glide, but same basic idea.
Right.
But they came across it
independent. Yeah, independent evolution. So this is an interesting theory. According to some new research, this idea that specifically the languages of Eurasia are all descended from sort of a super language that existed about 15,000 years ago during the last ice age. And some new research has actually given this idea some traction. So basically, imagine during the last ice age, most of the human beings in Eurasia were sort of in the same area, you know, shivering. And as the ice age receded and they spread out, the language they were speaking split apart into about, I think they said, seven superfamilies, which in turn splintered, and you get all the different variations of languages that you find across Eurasia. So linguists have long debated this idea, and the reason is because words sort of have a 50% chance of being replaced by an unrelated term every 2,000 to 4,000 years. So the idea that you could have a constant chain of words going back 15,000 years seems kind of crazy. But apparently, some words last much longer. So in a previous study, Mark Pagel, who is an evolutionary biologist and the person who led this research, found out that frequently used words, pronouns, numbers, adverbs, tend to survive for tens of thousands of years before other words replace them. So they're very long-lasting. You know, words like I, we, etc. tend to stay around a lot longer. So for their latest study, they used a computer to predict words that change really rarely, that they would retain some of their Eurasian language heritage. And then they checked this list against a database of early words reconstructed. And apparently, they found a lot of words that were very similar. These, what they called ultra-conserved words, included things like I and we, and they were used, they found that they're type of words that we use currently once per 1,000 in everyday speech. So those type of words are 7 to 10 times more likely to show up in deep ancestry, possibly 15,000 years ago. So it's a really intriguing idea. This demonstrates how linguists are using the concept of evolution to understand the development of languages. We look for similarities between words, what we would call cognates, and they're sort of like transitional fossils. We can go, okay, so this word in English is very similar to this word in French, which is also very similar to it in Swedish. And then we say, okay, well, maybe the root in these old versions of the language is very similar to this language, which is totally different. Why are they similar? And we can sort of trace this back and get a really good idea of where they may have developed.
The article itself, though, doesn't it, I mean, so one of the problems you always have here with the idea of evolutionary biology or even evolutionary psychology, which is, I think, this is more akin to the psychology than the biology aspect.
Probably, yeah.
Is you can't really go back and see the evidence. I mean, there is no fossilized vocal tract. And I know they're trying to do this through statistical methods, but again, because the only speaking life form on the planet that we understand are us, we can't even be sure that this sort of idea is even valid to use. I mean, from what I'm reading, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, it says that he has like 23 words that he thought were sort of, you know, proto-language, but that those words only were defined because they came up in at least four of the languages. So even then, a lot of the language base he's using, it doesn't come up that often. It's at least four, but it could be seven, or, you know, I mean, like, so again, the methodology, I have some questions with.
Yeah, it's definitely not like an exact science. And I mean, it would be better if they could like unearth like a tablet, a Rosetta Stone or something that they could just look up. Oh, that makes sense. But, you know, they don't. What's interesting, though, is that I looked at some of the articles in different sources, and a few of them had people who were not necessarily on board with his theory, but admitted that it's still you know, it's reasonably possible, and that even if they didn't descend from a common language, they may have been what we could consider like related languages. So you may have had, you know, I'm just going to be simplistic here, but assume you had two tribes in the Ice Age, and one tribe spoke the ancestor of English, and one side spoke the ancestor of Chinese. They may have lived very close to each other and occasionally exchanged vocabulary, but they weren't like one language. So that could have also happened.
Yeah, and I noticed, like, so this is Eurasian languages. What about North American languages or African languages? I mean, I think one of the things that, again, they're not making a strong claim here, so I want to take this, but the phenome set, right? The phenome set for Asian languages and European languages are quite different. And you'd think that if they came from a sort of a common heritage, because, I mean, that's really the foundation of all language is your phenome, you know, the a, u, a sort of things. And you think that would have been conserved if they all came from sort of one universal. I mean, again, you get some really weird ones in Africa where they use, you know, the clicks and all that sort of thing, right? And you think, well, those people, something happened to make that change. But even with that in consideration, most of their phenomes are still common amongst their local
area. It is. I mean, in that sense, it is kind of hard to believe. It's a little bit far-fetched sounding, but I think that we got to keep in mind how much like space is between them. And I mean, sort of like you can look at some of the like languages in China or Japan and go, well, they're so different from languages in Western Europe. But keep in mind, they had a lot of time to move. And, you know, it's more sort of like the languages in China are related to languages maybe in Mongolia or Eastern Russia, which are related to this one, which are related to that one. And then you have the common ancestor that connects them both, right? So it's not like you're going to find English words in Chinese or Chinese words in English, but you're going to find similarities in this one common ancestor way back then.
It does make it seem, though, that's it. But another thing, though, too, that I wonder if he's again, this is one of the problems when you try and use the Wayback Machine that's not really a Wayback Machine, is are these artifacts maybe a part of the machinery, right? So we are all humans. We all have the same brain. We have the same vocal tract. We have all the same sort of genetic predisposition for language. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's something in that machinery that leads to what appears to be a common ancestry, but is really just evolutionary overlap.
Yeah, like maybe these words are just selected, not just across from a parent language, but just across all language in general.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like for some reason, and I mean, again, this is all speculative, but the most common one he has in his listing here is thou, right? And well, maybe thou. Physically, it's something that's just easy that comes out. And like again, just for quirks in the machinery of humanity, that's just that came out to be easy. Hey, it's easy. So it's the first thing I'm going to say, first thing I'm going to make reference is myself or to you. And so that's why it comes across. But the next question I'm asking, so why is this important?
Well, I think it's interesting simply from a sort of science point of view. It's always neat to learn this kind of stuff. But I think it's interesting from the point of view of understanding how our language develops and how our culture develops, because I believe that language and culture are pretty tied close together. And one of the things that we hear a lot about in modern days are things like preserving national culture. I mean, this is really a big deal in France for obvious reasons. And, you know, they have laws there about words not being accepted into French, right? Yep. And we kind of joke around about how, you know, things like tweeting and, you know, Facebook me are becoming things, like verbs and all. And I think it's kind of silly because our language has been doing this for a really long time. I'm sure that way back, like 8,000 years ago, some like guy was hanging out with like at the fishing pond, and like some other tribe came by and they were using some kind of term, and he was like, that's a cool term. I'm gonna start using it back at my tribe. And they're like, what are you talking about? What is this fishing thing that you're talking about, you know? And I can just picture this happening, and it seems so likely in that sense. And, you know, given how fast we're globalizing, you know, I can imagine that in a couple hundred years we're going to have a really sort of monolithic language full of all these different combinations. It's going to be really weird.
Well, actually, you know, and that actually leads maybe to some urgency in doing this kind of research, because one of the things that I imagine is an issue is cross-contamination, right? I mean, you sort of hinted at it earlier about, you know, when the first guy going across the steppes of Mongolia met the first guy coming from the Yangtze River, they meet and they swap words, and that's maybe why some of the commonality. But, I mean, as we are evolving a sort of global language, there will not be different language sets to even pick from. It'll be just one monolith, at which point it becomes harder to, you know, well, where geographically was Chinese invented? And I mean, right now, obviously, well, it's right here. But when there is no such thing as Chinese, what happens to that question?
Yeah, exactly. Like, anyone who's ever traveled across Canada knows that we have different dialects across Canada. But at a certain point, are those dialects going to solely vanish, replaced by kind of this monolithic way of speaking?
And what happens then to our study of language?
Who knows?
And then what happens to the whole idea of evolutionary psychology?
Ooh. Let's go to a commercial break on that note. That's a hanging Chad.
Hanging, which is something very election-y.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's go to a break here on Radio Free Thinker. I'll be back after this.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don,
there's a big coming up.
I don't know. Is there?
Yes. Actually, we should note to our value listeners that next week we will be having a best of Radio Free Thinker, because both me and Ethan are running the election. And by running the election, yes, we mean we personally will be responsible for selecting who will win each particular riding. Well, okay, maybe not, but we will be participating in the election. So with an election looming and us often complaining that people are ill-informed, I thought we'd take a moment to review some of the major issues and what each party plans to do about them. So this is going to be a little loose and general, but we'll see if we can cover. So first of all, healthcare. One of the defining features of being Canadian is our public healthcare system. However, with advances in technology, pharmaceuticals, and an ever-aging population, the cost of healthcare has become a major issue. Healthcare spending in BC currently sits about $17 billion a year, or about 40% of the provincial budget, and is expected to rise to $19 billion by the year 2015. The BC Liberals have, over the past year, raised healthcare premiums to help with funding. The cost of to an individual has increased from $57 in 2009 to this year hitting over $65 a month. That's like a 14% increase. And this only brings in about $2 billion. This, of course, only covers part of the expense. In an effort to sort of reduce expenditures, more and more healthcare costs are being shifted from the public sphere to the private or personal expense area. So in the past, if you went to the hospital and you had a boo-boo, they'd give you some dressings or whatever so that you can change your bandage later on when you got home. Now you got to go to the Shoppers and buy your own. The cost of an ambulance. Thought it was free? Nope. Cost you money. So again, just a quick little refresher here. We don't actually have a public healthcare system per se. The UK does, where everyone works for the government that's in healthcare. What we have is what they call a single payer system. That is, we have a privately run healthcare providers who essentially submit insurance claims, like for your knee surgery or something, to the BC government, and in BC, the BC Health Insurance pays it. You can get private insurance to cover what the BC Health doesn't, like those ambulances or your prescriptions. So one way that they're trying to lower costs is to just not cover as much stuff, which has always been a big issue. It's noted that the BC Medical Association showed British Columbians are the least able to afford prescription drugs in the country. That's pretty weird. So what do the parties say they're going to do this? And okay, I'm going to admit right at the back. In this election, there are only two parties. There are the BC NDP and the BC Liberals. Yes, Conservatives and Greens are running. But from most what pundits said, there's actually going to be far more independents. And they have much more greater chance of getting in. I think something like half a dozen or so independents are expected to be elected. Nobody expects a single Conservative or a single Green guy to even have a realistic chance. So I'm skipping them, which isn't really fair, but let's keep focused. So the New Democrats, they have promised to expand the PharmaCare program to include more classes of drugs and encourage doctors to prescribe lower-costing generic drugs. Not bad. They want to expand home support and community care for seniors and people with disability, people with chronic conditions. So those people who aren't in hospital and they've sent them home, but they still need medical attention, the government will help pick up a bit more of that tab. An establishment of an independent seniors representative, so someone, an officer who's essentially an advocate on behalf of seniors, which is, I think, the largest growing constituency in the province.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at least for another 20 years, and then they'll be passed on.
Well, it's a growing demographic across the country, basically.
Yes, because of the baby boomers, but they're all going to die one day.
Well, we're all going to die one day.
Not me.
Okay, fine. Powers. A few of us won't die.
So next they're going to do is they're going to strengthen primary and community health care services to replace your auto care. So again, this is mainly focused for rural areas because that's another area that's suffered a lot from funding cutbacks. Increase access to mental health and addiction services. Again, rebuilding some of the lost capabilities of rural hospitals. And this is the one I like the best. Restore the therapeutic initiative's role as BC's drug watchdog and make its expertise available to private drug plans, clinics, and the consumer. So the therapeutic initiative, it's based out of UBC, and it does sort of an independent analysis on the efficacy of drug treatments. Essentially, it's intended to be a bit of a balance against corporate-sponsored drug research, which has shown in the past to be a tad biased. Now, you may have noticed, and just this is what I noticed, a lot of what the NDP are promising are sort of vague and not very specific. And so that leads you to wonder how much of it's just politics and how much of it isn't. The BC Liberals, in contrast, are actually very, very specific. So they mentioned that they're going to provide resources to increase the number of mental health beds and facilities in UBC. And they actually give numbers to those. They plan to invest a further $2.4 billion in healthcare over the next 3 years. Which I think falls short of how much they said it's going to expect to cost. But they continue to spend $123.4 million on GP for Me programs. essentially the idea is that now a lot of people now don't actually have a family doctor, and this is trying to hook up doctors with patients for sort of a long-term relationship, because again, sometimes the healthcare issues are long-term and you don't see it if you don't have a relationship with that doctor. Encourages development to double the number of hospice spaces by partnering with hospice societies. And for those who aren't sure what hospice is, that's essentially a place you go when it's time to die. So people have incurable cancer, curable diseases. There's no cure. You know you're going to die. So they send you to a place where you get to spend your last days as comfortable as possible. They're going to create an additional 500 additional spaces in the province by 2017, a little far in the future, for addiction relationships, and that's in partnership with nonprofit operators. Provide $12 million over the next 3 years to complete the funding necessary to expand the number of medical students spaces to 288, up from 128 in 2001. You may ask, why 2001? Well, that's the last time we had a NDP government, or that's the numbers they keep using for their benchmarks, which is, again, a good thing to do. More doctors you have, the more access people have to healthcare. Encourage new physicians to move to British Columbia by providing $1 million annually to apply to some loan forgiveness programs for these particular units. So again, although far more specific, much of the quote plan was trying to A, spin past works, which I guess I don't blame them for. I mean, you have to say, hey, look, we did all this great stuff. But there are a lot of uncomfortable allusions to NGOs as partners for much of what they promise. So I'm not sure how much of this is the actual government planning to do or how much it's trying to get others to do sort of for them. Lots of times, like I say, this could be a good government initiative, but it might also be sort of a green light for private actors to do public works, which personally I'm not for. Other people may be for. I'm not trying to advocate for one or the other, but yes, I do have my biases. Ethan, what do you think is going to be the major healthcare issue of this election?
Well, I mean, the thing with healthcare is that it's not really a specific issue. It's just sort of, yes, we like healthcare and we're going to fund it. Snap. Those are the cameras going off. Yeah. That's sort of what I've noticed, at least, is that there's never really any tangible details. I mean, even these, in terms of details, they're not even that clear. Like, it's just, we're going to throw, you know, X million dollars at this thing, and we're going to throw X million dollars at this thing. And there's no, what is that going to do? Like, why do you need that kind of, like, are they out of beds? Like, what's the, why do we need that money there? There's very little details about what it's going to do. Are they going to hire new people, or how is that going to work?
Well, you know what? I think one of the things, and you'll see this reoccurring theme, is most political pundits basically say this is a walk away for the NDP, barring the fact that we find out that they really are communist stooges or something like that. So you kind of have one party, which is the NDP, who really don't want to say anything because anything they say could potentially be turned against them. So the less they say, really, the better it is for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the other side, who are so far behind, but they're so far behind because of their past record, and they don't really want to say anything beyond that, because again, it might upset they don't want to make a bad situation worse.
Well, there has been talk that the Liberals have been catching up to the NDP. I don't know if that's really true or if that's just be sort of the natural cycle when you have basically a two-party race. Of course, it goes back to any sort of political group, no matter how much you may hate your party, you're going to vote for your party regardless, right? So,
actually, no. See, this is one of the things, and you see this more in the States than you do in Canada. Well, you see it in Canada, too. We're just less visible with it. Sometimes people will not vote for their party, and they will not vote for the opponent's party, but they'll just not vote.
Well, that's, the other alternative, right? Like, I think that regardless of, I think it's going to be close in a lot of races, and I think that for a lot of people, they don't necessarily even care what they hear about healthcare. They just want to hear someone talk about healthcare, and just so that they can have that confidence that yes, I'm not voting for the party that wants to kill people or something, you know. And I think that's unfortunate. I think that our healthcare has real problems that need to be solved, and we need to put some serious effort into doing it. And I haven't seen anything from any party that really comes close to addressing any of that. It just seems like buzz campaigning.
True. And actually, my biggest bugaboo in BC is healthcare premiums. I mean, I understand we have to pay for healthcare, and that's great. But I see healthcare as more of a right right? And therefore, the idea that you have to pay the premiums strikes me as wrong. I mean, sure, add an extra 1% or 2% to my income taxes, great, because, I mean, we have to pay for it, unless they don't pay for it. But it strikes me almost offensive that it's somehow something you buy as opposed to something you have.
I would really, I think, appreciated it more if I had seen things like promises to expand harm reduction drug policy, or, you know, building more mental health facilities, or, and like specifically saying, here's where we're going to build it. Here's the land we're going to buy to build it on, you know?
Now, again, to be fair, a lot of the BC Liberal platform does have a lot of specifics in it. I mean, for the show, I couldn't say too much in that. But like they say, well, there's a plan to build something here, and we're going to build it here, right? Or we've already started this project here, right? So I think, and again, because of where each party is coming from, the NDP is much more political and fuzzy about that than the Liberals are. So that's where that comes from. But then the other issue, which we kind of just alluded to about money, is the economy. So first thing I should mention is most experts about the economy have the opinion that what a BC government does is relatively irrelevant, barring sort of some extraordinary move, regarding our economic future prosperity, because we're still, by and large, a resource economy. And as such, factors on the global market, vis-a-vis commodity pricing, will actually have a far more significant effect on the health of our economy than anything Victoria does, which is kind of sad, but it's the way things are going. Alberta right now is suffering a lot of this, is they had sort of pegged their hopes on the price of oil, and they're having to discount their oil because the market dictates that, and they're losing out on a lot of potential revenue, whereas if they'd sort of refined their own oil at home, they would be in a much stronger position. The good news is we actually have a high minimum wage relative to the rest of the country at $1.25. Same as Ontario and Manitoba. Nova Scotia is more enlightened with a minimum of 10.30. The territories, like the Yukon's 10.30 as well, and Nunavut is $11. The BC Federation of Labor, however, is pushing the province to go even further and considering raising it to $11.11, which sounds like a weird number. And for those of you who might think it's a bit of extravagance, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives argues that a single person currently working full-time doesn't actually make enough to live above the poverty line on our current minimum wage. That a person who works 40 hours a week for 50 weeks of the year would need to make the $11.11 just to be above the poverty line, at least in Vancouver. It depends on where you live. The expenses are slightly different. Neither party, though, is promising anything on this particular issue. So it's sort of a dead issue, even though it's something that seems to be somewhat resonant in some degree. Another major issue is temporary foreign worker program. Of course, this has been really big in the news lately because of the Royal Bank, quote-unquote, outsourcing, and it's been the foreign worker program by the federal government. The province has also taken heat for hiring more than 200 foreign workers from China to work in coal mines in northeastern BC. HD Mining has said that it hired workers in Tumbler Ridge region because the 300 or so Canadians who applied for the job weren't qualified. Of course, it has come out since then that one of the qualifications apparently on the list was you needed to be able to speak Mandarin, which strikes me as a little weird for a Canadian company. Sorry, a Canadian mine, but it is run by a Chinese company. So that's it. Two labor unions behind the core challenge of the temporary foreign worker argue that Canadians could have filled the job and the company rejected multiple people who were well qualified. So there's a court challenge going on to this particular issue itself. The Temporary Foreign Worker Program, which straddles both federal and provincial jurisdictions, allows a company to import workers when no Canadian people can be found. Now, in the past, this has been used for things like celebrities or that sort of thing. But now it's really kind of devolved where it's become an excuse just to bring in people at a lower wage because, one, foreign workers are a bit more insecure. They can't quit their job because if they do, they got to go back. Two, up until recently, you can actually pay them less. In BC, we still have our apprentice payment program, which is provincial, where you can pay them almost half the minimum wage while they train up, which strikes me as sort of the inverse of what you'd want to do. But anyway, that's one other issue on the horizon. To sort of switch gears, BC has been called Hollywood North, and another major issue is keeping movie making here in Vancouver. BC film tax credit is currently set at 33% of labor cost. Well, Ontario and Quebec have granted actually a 25% tax credit, but on all the film costs. There have been a number of calls by the local film industry to become more competitive. The BC Liberals have pledged to introduce a new policy for film industry within the next few weeks, but would not commit to any tax changes the industry is asking for. The Liberals have said, essentially, that currently they're getting about $285 million a year in tax breaks, and that's generous enough. They don't want to participate with Ontario in a sort of race to the bottom when it comes to handing out subsidies to the film industry. The New Democrats, on the other hand, have a slightly different take. They will increase the labor tax credit for the film industry to 40% for an additional cost of about $45 million. Now, it's a bit better than Ontario because, again, these are labor costs, so by definition, you have to be hiring local people to fill this. So in that sense, it makes it kind of a benefit. But again, how important is it to have Canada as the film studio for American audiences? Ethan, thoughts?
Well, I guess take it in reverse order. So the filming thing is interesting because I have a few friends who were involved in the film industry in Saskatchewan, which killed its tax credit for filming, and its industry dried up, and they all moved to BC. So it's probably a good idea to have some kind of tax credit. Now, the interesting thing, I think, well, BC can get by on the fact that we're sort of like the only place in Canada that doesn't rain or snow all the time. So that's kind of like if they want to...
Rain?
Well, we get rain, but I mean, if they want to film something that looks like it's filmed somewhere else, Vancouver's sort of their only option. So we can kind of, I think, coast by on that, whereas Ontario and Quebec kind of can't.
Well, we also have the advantage that if you need a snow scene, you can go up the mountain and get snow and then come back down and do the summer scene.
Yeah, and so I think that it's probably a good thing. Like, I know back when we had a lot of TV shows that were filming, Stargate and et cetera, it did throw in a lot of money into the local economy. So I think it's if we can get it, good. But I don't think we should sort of hedge our bets on it. I think that if we can come up with a competitive tax credit that's not extravagant, that's not crazy, then go for it. But again, you know.
What about this idea of race to the bottom?
Well, I don't think we need to do that. Like, I think that we can get by on our environment.
I think you're saying get by on our good looks.
Well, that too, frankly. One thing that I thought was interesting is the notion of the minimum wage. Now, I mean, I'm no expert on economics, but wouldn't it make more sense to, instead of keep raising the minimum wage, to focus on, like, price fixing of things like tuition and, like, cost of living expenses? I mean, if we just keep raising the minimum wage, that's going to keep pushing inflation up and up and up, right? Like, I remember when I went from making, I don't know, was it like $8.50? And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm making like an extra $3. And then I just, the next couple of years, everything was $3 more expensive. So it wasn't exactly like I got anything extra out of it. As soon as they catch on that you're making more money, they can charge you more for stuff.
True, but a lot of the price in a lot of items are much more elastic than you'd think they'd be. Mm. Just for example, and I'm really curious, this is going to be a case study, so people keep your eyes open. The federal government, I think it's federal government, could be provincial, is slashing the price of cheese to wholesalers. So your Domino's Pizza will be able to get the cheese for it really, really cheap compared to what they're paying now. The restaurateurs themselves expect about a 40% decrease in the price of a pizza.
Wow.
Now, here's the test. Are they going to pass that savings on to you? Or are they just going to go, cha-ching, we got more money?
My guess is on the cha-ching, but...
It'll be interesting to see. But yeah, no, most times minimum wages are... Well, again, see, I mean, in the old days, when we were a much more socialist country, and even the Americans in the 70s had wage and price controls, because you are right, they both kind of need to be worked hand in hand. But again, I think there's more elasticity in a lot of the pricing that would compensate for that. But we'll see. So moving on now to education. Of course, this is an issue that's usually dear and near to the skeptical community. British Columbia saw almost half a year-long bitter labor dispute between teachers and the BC government last year, which ended up when government introduced back to work legislation. After being without a contract for about a year, teachers ultimately ratified agreement, but they did so under duress because they wanted to avoid fines and penalties and punitive damages. So that's always a big issue that's sort of looming out there. Is there going to be a big backlash from organized labor? In the year 2013, the average full-time tuition fees in BC reached over $5,000, up 7% from $4,700 in 2009, and up almost 177% since 91. Which at that time, and I can hardly believe that tuition would be like $1,800. Wow.
Give me a time machine, Jesus.
Yeah. So the average student debt in BC is estimated to be about $27,000, which really strikes me as a bit low, but okay. And that's not including the interest charges above that, which will add about an extra 25% to the actual costing to students. The Canadian Federation of Students has called on the province to axe interest charges at all on student loans and actually to launch more student grant programs. I should note that there are 25 nations out there that provide university education for free, and some of them are really nice countries, so Barbados, Spain, Scotland, Italy, Germany, France, Denmark, even Brazil and Argentina, and there's a few more. So it's something that's doable. So what are the parties saying about this? The NDP say they're going to establish a $100 million needs-based, non-repayable student grant program to help improve accessibility. Now, of course, I think non-repayable and grant are the same word, so I'm not sure why they worded it that way. They plan to create a scholarship fund for post-secondary education skill training in a one-time $20 million sort of investment, and they're hoping to do a partnership with the private sector and community-based partners to make that even bigger for scholarships. Develop new and targeted programs to increase the participation of Northern residents, First Nation people, and women in trades training. Restore provincial support to the BC Program for Awareness and Learning of Science. So what's this you're asked for? The Science World at one time sort of had a traveling science show that went throughout the province to help educate people about science. It was actually started by the Liberals under Campbell, but last year got axed in budget cuts. So they promised to reinstitute that. Create a provincial-wide standard for school code of conduct aimed at preventing bullying. The Liberals, on the other hand, have committed significant funds to address classroom size and composition challenges across the province. They promise to limit tuition fees to a maximum of 2% throughout the next term of office. Actually, I thought the NDP said they were going to freeze it. I had that in my notes, but I must have erased it at some point. So the NDP say they're freezing tuition fees. Liberals say they're going to limit it to 2%. They're also going to provide free textbooks to university and college students. Which you go, woohoo, because I mean, anyone who's going to university knows those can be really, really expensive. Well, this is sort of a half promise. What they will be doing is making available online the 40 most used textbooks with an additional 20 more to be added after that has been done. And actually, they're also partnering this up with textbooks for high school and elementary school students. And I'm not sure whether that 40 number includes all the books or whether it's 40 for university and another 40 for elementary. That we'll see what happens after the election.
I'll believe that when I see it.
The government will partner with publicly funded post-secondary institutions. I'm going to save that one for next. $80 million is going to be added to a program to increase youth participation in the arts, which is good. So the one that really stuck a craw in my throat is the government is planning to partner with publicly funded post-secondary institutions to develop a school of traditional Chinese medicine. Ethan.
Wow.
What do you think about traditional Chinese medicine in a non-racial context?
Well, of course it's non-racial context. I mean, science is science. That's just ludicrous and sad. There goes however much money they're going to spend on that down the toilet. I mean, yeah, not good.
Yeah, no, and again, I mean, where we're aiming this is, it's, you know, not that Chinese medicine is bad, but usually traditional Chinese medicine, and usually tradition is a big word here, is code word for things like herbalism, acupuncture, feng shui, healing. Well,
there's a whole school of thought that goes under this umbrella term that is, it's non-science-based medicine, and it's contributed to the extinction of rare and endangered animals. It's potentially dangerous. And yeah, it's like there's a cottage industry of extorting money from people using this term.
So the last area really to talk about is the environment. And oddly enough, very little about the environment is talked about in environmental policy. It almost all hinges around fossil fuels, mainly selling them and moving them around. So there's the tar sands as well as liquid natural gas, pipelines and tankers with natural gas comes the controversial practice of fracking. Now, they have made some comments about forestry and all that, but it's very minor in their platforms. So the NDP say they support liquid natural gas development and export to diversify their economy. They want to ensure the best practices around LNG, which is short for liquid natural gas, and hydraulic fracking. They want to encourage development of green energy and options to reduce environmental footprint of LNG development. They oppose the Northern Gateway pipeline, but that said, later on in their platform, they said something weird, where they want to establish a Made in BC environmental assessment of the Enbridge North Gateway pipeline, the Kinder Morgan expansion. And so they're sort of saying, we're against the pipeline, but we might be for it if we come up with the idea, which I'm not sure means you're actually for it. You just want to do it your own way. They want to maintain a moratorium on offshore drilling. They want to use a portion of the carbon tax to actually expand public transit, which is good. They want to implement the Cohen Commission's protection of wild salmon, which was a weird one that came out of nowhere for me. Essentially, what this means is they want to start capping the number of fish farms we have in BC. And I didn't know this either. I focus too much sometimes on federal politics, not on provincial. So they want to eliminate the BC Liberals' restriction on the development of new power sources by BC Hydro. And they want to do this by renewing BC Hydro's mandate to meet BC's requirements for energy and to focus on developing renewable energy sources in the province. The Liberals, for their part, they want to receive essentially their fair share for the oil project. So they're saying, we're all for the Gateway Pipeline, but we want to make sure that we get as much money out of it as we can. They actually believe in creating a prosperity fund, largely financed from LNC, to fund future improvements and to pay off the government and Crown debt. So they have a lot of big hope for liquid natural gas. I should point that the Liberals say that through the LNG investment, that within about 2 years, they should make enough money to sort of wipe out the deficit. CBC did a reality check, and they actually think that this is wrong. In the past, the Liberals have almost doubled the expectation of revenue coming in than what they actually got. And most experts agree that as going forward, liquid natural gas has actually become much more cheaper. So they're putting a lot of hopes on this, but it doesn't look like it's going to pan out. They want to direct all revenue for fishing licenses to the Forestry Service for conservation activities, which is good. Oh yeah, this weird one I came across. They want to consult, quote, on Water Sustainability Act in 2003 with the intention of passing this legislation in 2014. The act will protect BC's aquifers and drinking water resources while providing industry with a framework under which drinking water allocations are made. When I first read that, I wasn't sure what the heck they were talking about. Then I cross-referenced in my mind fracking, which requires lots and lots and lots of water. So water management is becoming a big thing for industrial development. And from what I understand, the Liberals are planning to double the water permits, plus maybe make them a bit easier to get. Final thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to shut up. I found some weird things in their policies. This is not related to any particular issue. The Liberals are planning to add $2 million to enhance treatment and prevention of gambling, which I thought was a good thing. They're going to freeze personal income tax rate for the next 5 years. They are going to reduce the amount you can get charged for a payday loan by almost 20%, which is quite good. Weird one, but I guess it's important. And they're going to give, like this one, they were going to give small business owners a 40% tax cut. You go, wow, 40%. But what that actually goes from is they're going from 2.5% to 1.5% tax. So they're only getting like 1% down, but it's 40% of what they're paying now. The NDP has some neat ones as well. They're going to end the corporate and union donations to political parties. They're going to raise the corporate tax rate from 11 to 12%. They're going to ban taxpayer-funded partisan advertising and pass legislation to ensure all government advertising is reviewed and approved by the Auditor General. And the Auditor General is usually seen as a nonpartisan neutral player. And this one, which I went, wow, in order to increase voter turnout, how do you increase voter turnout? The best way is to expand what voter turnout is. So they're going to lower the voting age to 16 years. Now, that being said, the Green Party are the only party that are calling for a changing of our first-past-the-post voting system. And because I really think the current voting system we have sucks hugely, I'm going to actually vote for them.
Well, throw your vote away then. Well, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. So just quickly, let's do through our skeptical highlights. Saturday, May 11th, go to CFI for Thinkers Book Club, A Universe from Nothing, which is happening at 1 p.m. at the Grind Coffee Shop. And the following week, on Saturday, May 18th, there is Cafe Inquiry, Why Nuclear Power? And that's happening in room 1520 of SFU Harbor Center. And we'll be talking about why nuclear power.
A glowing conversation, I'm sure.
We'll be great.
I only have two this week. First one, Women in Science, H.R. McMillan Space Center, Thursday, May 9th, 7 p.m. Find Your Path to Engineering and Science, From Taxidermy to Robots by Maxine Chim. Maxine will share how she achieved an animal biology degree and a mechanical engineering degree, and how they have helped shape both her career and her personal endeavors. Drawing on experience from high school, university, co-op work placement, and a recent graduate of UBC, she will discuss how her passion for these fields has been a springboard to academic success. So listen to that. And the other thing is, go to your party's platform and find out what they actually stand for. Be an informed electorate. Go out and do some research. I did some. You get to do more.
Alrighty.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying, thanks for listening.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent